From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Air Asia confirms that recovered bodies and debris are from a missing plane. A political foe of Russian President Vladimir Putin is convicted of embezzlement, but his sentence is suspended.
He's a very prominent critic of President Putin. He's an opposition figure, and he's been an activist against corruption for many years.
And scientists celebrate how their research helps medical patients. It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. Indonesian officials have recovered at least 40 bodies from the sea near the wreckage of an Air Asia passenger jet that crashed during a storm Sunday. Local television today showed rescue helicopters pulling bodies from the Java Sea, about 160 kilometers off the coast of Borneo Island. Families of those on board the plane burst into tears after seeing the first images of the bloated bodies, which were not wearing life jackets. By nightfall, rescuers had recovered only a quarter of those on board the jet. None of the passengers or crew have been found alive. The bodies were located shortly after the discovery of wreckage, including what appeared to be an orange life jacket, luggage, and a red and white emergency door. Aerial searches have also uncovered what appears to be a shadow under the surface of the water that is believed to be the main body of the Airbus A320-200. In a statement late Tuesday, Air Asia confirmed the wreckage was the missing plane, which disappeared Sunday about halfway through what was supposed to be a brief two-hour flight from the Indonesian city of Surabaya to Singapore. A Russian court today found political activist Alexei Navalny guilty of defrauding a French cosmetics company of at least $500,000. The court sentenced the 38-year-old lawyer and blogger to a 3.5-year suspended prison sentence in the case, far lower than the 10 years sought by prosecutors. Navalny's brother Oleg was also convicted and received the same sentence, but was ordered to jail. The court was originally supposed to deliver the verdict on January 15th, but moved up the date with no explanation of its decision. VOA correspondent Daniel Scharf in Moscow was asked by VOA's Victor Beatty about Mr. Navalny's background leading up to this latest court case.
Well, he's a very prominent critic of President Putin. He's an opposition figure, and he's been an activist against corruption for many years. He was actually a mayoral candidate a little over a year ago here in Moscow and came in second place. But he's also, because of his outspoken criticism of the government, of President Putin and authorities, he has been charged on numerous occasions with fraud, embezzlement, and so forth, and has been spent a little bit of time in jail. He's been arrested, but mostly he's been kept under house arrest, especially since the beginning of this year, since February. And now this current verdict was about an alleged fraud case. And he has been found guilty along with his brother, Oleg. But while Navalny, Alexei Navalny, was sentenced to 3.5 years in prison suspended, which means just more or less a continuation of his house arrest, his brother Oleg has received jail time for 3.5 years, which came as quite a surprise to a lot of the watchers of the trial.
What about the timing of this verdict? I understand it was moved up a couple of weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is another thing that really struck everyone. Yesterday, the court suddenly announced first to Navalny's lawyers and then publicly that they had already come up with a verdict. And so they would be announcing it the following day, which is today, rather than on January 15th, as they had originally planned. Now, that came as quite suspicious to a lot of people because Navalny supporters had planned a very large protest just outside of the Kremlin in support of him on January 15th. And the number of people signing up to attend that protest had reached over 33,000 in just a matter of a couple of weeks. So a lot of people felt, a lot of analysts and reporters and observers, that this was an obvious attempt to try and, get the verdict out before those protests, before people have a chance to organize and get out on the streets of Moscow.
Of course, this comes after a much earlier high-profile trial involving a Russian businessman, Mr. Khodorkovsky.
Yeah, and this is actually coming on the anniversary of that that verdict. So it certainly seems to have some symbolic timing. But the overall impression that most people are getting is, and outside of the court today, there was a lot of reaction that this sentencing of Alexei Navalny's brother Oleg, while he only received, Alexei himself only received a suspended sentence, seems to be an old Soviet tactic, an old KGB tactic, in fact, of going after the family rather than trying to make a martyr out of the person that you want to shut up. So that certainly is a big concern, and we're probably going to see a lot more political analysts making those same remarks. Certainly that's what Alexei Navalny's supporters, his lawyer, his spokesperson are saying, that this appears to be very much a tactic of going after the family to try and shut up the man that you don't want going public against you. And we have to remember, of course, that President Putin is a former KGB operative himself, so this could very much fall into that that pattern.
This verdict comes down as Ukraine's President, Mr. Poroshenko, has indicated that he'll meet Mr. Putin next month regarding the crisis in Ukraine. Also, Russia is trying to come out of a spiral with regard to its economy and its currency, the ruble. Any linkage at all with these events?
Well, certainly it's going to be, it's always a good thing whenever the leaders of Ukraine and Russia are willing to talk. At least it's going to hopefully calm down the situation in eastern Ukraine, where we've seen some serious fighting in the last year that's killed thousands of people. So these talks in Astana in Kazakhstan next month, which are coincidentally timed for January 15th, when the original verdict was going to happen, this is it's a good sign when they're sitting down at the table rather than exchanging accusations. As far as you know, any other linkage between the economy and you know, what's been going on in Ukraine and the trial, it's really not directly linked in any way that we can see. Of course, whenever there is any sort of political instability inside Russia or any sort of indication that the rule of law is not prevailing, it does have an effect on the markets. And we did see a slight drop in the value of the ruble when the verdict came in this morning against Alexei Navalny and his brother.
VOA's Daniel Scharf in Moscow. 4 years after the uprisings that shattered the decades-old status quo in the Middle East, 2015 promises to be another year of tumultuous change, presenting new challenges for U.S. foreign policy leaders. VOA correspondent Meredith Buell looks ahead to expectations for the region in the new year.
Just a year ago, few people had heard of the Islamic State terrorist group. But after a lightning-quick takeover of large parts of Syria and Iraq, the jihadis have been labeled an imminent threat to many other countries. Hundreds of airstrikes appear to have slowed IS momentum, and analysts like Paul Salem of the Middle East Institute predict more gains in the new year.
I think the fight against the Islamic State will progress in Iraq. I think Iraq, between the Kurdish army and the National Army based in Baghdad, with strong U.S. support, will make progress in 2015.
But progress looks less likely in Syria, where the U.S. is planning to train moderate rebels. Former U.S. Ambassador to Syria Robert Ford says more needs to be done.
If we don't help friends on the ground very quickly, there will be no choice in Syria except Bashar al-Assad on one side and jihadi extremists on the other.
IS caught the West's attention with gruesome beheadings and other atrocities. Johns Hopkins professor Daniel Serwer says IS has gone too far.
I think I would bet on it to lose some territory because I think it's making serious mistakes, especially in Iraq, where it has slaughtered members of several Sunni tribes.
The Pentagon says there is evidence IS fighters have begun to move into Libya, where chaos has created a security crisis. General David Rodriguez leads the U.S. Africa Command.
People coming for training and logistics support right now as for training sites, and that's what we see right now. As far as a huge command and control network, have not seen that yet.
There is ongoing political turmoil in Yemen, which has seen several changes of leadership in recent months. Members of the Shiite Muslim Houthi movement are battling fighters from al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Again, Paul Salem.
The long look indicates that the Middle East in this century is going to be a very turbulent and unpredictable place.
Analysts say the raging wars in the Middle East are attracting a growing number of foreign fighters. For those trying to combat radical Islam, the challenges are increasingly complex. Meredith Buell, VOA News, Washington.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. President Barack Obama says as he enters the final 2 years of his presidency, and with the economy stronger at any time since taking office in 2009, he's able to focus on what he calls long-term projects in domestic and foreign affairs. VOA's Victor Beatty reports Mr. Obama, in an interview on U.S. public radio, also says he won't rule out improved relations with Iran and cites Myanmar and Tunisia as examples where democracy has a chance to advance.
In remarks to the U.S. public media organization NPR broadcast on Monday, Mr. Obama says his executive actions in recent weeks on immigration and Cuba were the result of years of work. He says he had foreseen 2014 as a breakthrough year, and after 6 years in office and an improving economy, he finally had the opportunity to deal with some thorny issues.
But at the end of 2014, I could look back and say we are as well positioned today as we have been in quite some time economically, that American leadership is more needed around the world than ever before. And that is liberating in the sense that a lot of the work that we've done is now beginning to bear fruit. And it gives me an opportunity then to start focusing on some of the other hard challenges that I didn't always have the time or the capacity to get to earlier in my presidency.
Mr. Obama says he now wants to focus on long-term projects, such as making sure all Americans benefit from an improving economy. And on the international front,
even as we're managing ISIL and trying to roll them back and ultimately defeat them, even as we've been executing the drawdown in Afghanistan in a responsible way, the moves like the Cuba diplomatic initiative are ones that I want to make sure I continue to pursue, partly because, frankly, it's easier for a president to do at the end of his term than a new president coming in.
When asked if he envisions opening an embassy in Tehran as he restores diplomatic ties with Cuba, Mr. Obama says the two countries are different. He says after 50 years of the same policy, it was time for a change with a tiny country that does not pose a significant threat. He calls Iran a large, sophisticated country with a history of state sponsorship of terrorism that is hostile to Israel and trying to develop a nuclear weapon. He says improved relations with Tehran will hinge on a verifiable nuclear agreement. Over time, he says, sanctions could be removed, Iran could be reintegrated into the international community, and that would serve as the basis for improving relations. The United States has not had diplomatic relations with Iran since 1980, after Iranian activists seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and took its staff hostage. The U.S. and five other nations have been negotiating for a peaceful civilian-Iranian nuclear program. Iran has long denied its program has a military purpose. Despite reaching an interim deal in November 2013, the two sides have failed to reach a comprehensive agreement and extended the talks into next year with a new deadline at the end of June. As for advancing democracy, human rights, good governance, and the rule of law, Mr. Obama points to Myanmar, also known as Burma, and Tunisia, where transformations appear to be underway. He says these are countries where the U.S. can be opportunistic and do everything it can to help. But when it comes to nation building in Libya, Syria, and Iraq, Mr. Obama refers to them as generational projects where the U.S. can help but cannot do it for them. As for Russia and its actions in Ukraine, the president says steady sanctions pressure is making the Russian economy sufficiently vulnerable and increasingly difficult to manage. Mr. Obama also says following costly conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, he wants to focus U.S. resources at home, rebuilding schools, roads, basic science, and research. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
The Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory on New York's Long Island may be relatively unknown to the public, but it is highly revered among biologists, geneticists, and other life science researchers. VOA's Adam Phillips attended the lab's Double Helix Awards ceremony in New York for our report.
It was evening dress only at an ultra-posh Manhattan venue where many of America's scientific and philanthropic elite gathered to honor three whom the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory deemed worthy of the 2014 Double Helix Medals. They're awarded each year to recognize those who've made outstanding contributions to the human understanding of genetics and the life sciences.
Tonight is not only a celebration of science and the people who support science, but I think an expression of the types of research that we do that is having an enormous impact in lots of different fields.
Bruce Stillman succeeded DNA co-discoverer James Watson as the lab's president in 2003.
For instance, just think about the world population. It's growing at a fairly significant rate. And how are we going to feed all of those people? And how are we going to create the energy that's needed to sustain our population over the next 100 or 200 years? We believe biology is going to be a major, major input in that, and genetics can have a major impact in those areas. One of our scientists has recently developed crops that actually double the yield of fruit, just purely by understanding the timing of flowering. And that's an amazing discovery. It's going to revolutionize agriculture.
But it's the genetics within humans, not just the genetic relationship between humans and other life forms, that make up most of the research work done at the lab, says spokeswoman Dagnia Zeidlikas.
The research that we do in biology can be categorized into a few separate categories. Genetics and genomics research, where we are studying genes and the human genome, the strand of DNA that makes you, you, and me, me, and then taking that information and translating it into understanding diseases like cancer, which is a genetic disease, understanding diseases like autism, like schizophrenia, which are genetic diseases, understanding other types of genetic functions in our body that would impact things like diabetes or obesity.
Matthew Messelson of Harvard University was awarded a Double Helix Medal for his discoveries on DNA replication and the evolution of sexual reproduction, among other things. He recalled how his love for biology and genetics was first aroused.
As a very young child, I wanted to understand what makes things alive. How could you take ordinary dust or inorganic matter and put those atoms together and get something that was living? And that we know now. That is one of the great accomplishments of modern biology. We know about DNA. We know how it replicates itself. We know how it controls the functions of cells and how cells develop to form whole organisms, their body pattern, and all that.
Marlo Thomas also garnered a medal. Already famous as a film and television star, best-selling author, and co-founder of Ms. Magazine, Thomas is widely acclaimed in her role as the National Outreach Director for the St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, a Midwestern facility that combines world-class medical research with free, compassionate care to kids with cancer and other genetic diseases.
Hope is our message. Children come from all over the country, all over the world, with death sentences from other hospitals. It's not that these other hospitals aren't good. They're good hospitals, but they're only working with what they know. We're working with what they don't know. We're working with what we don't know because we're a research center and a treatment center under one roof. So we're really finding we're studying disease, and then we make kids better too.
Families also have a place in the work of Double Helix honoree and National Book Award recipient Andrew Solomon. His bestseller, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, examines ways that Down syndrome, schizophrenia, autism, and other genetic conditions play out within families. Indeed, public education about biology and genetics is a key element of the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory's mission. Its on-site programs host thousands of school children every year, and it maintains several satellite centers around the world. Now more than ever, says spokeswoman Dagnia Zeidlikas, cutting-edge research goes hand-in-hand with an informed and engaged public. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Some inspiring stories there. Well, thanks for joining us today for International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
This is Today in History. On December 30th, 1922, the Union of the Soviet Socialist Republics was created within the territory of the former Russian Empire and included the Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian, and Transcaucasian Soviet republics. Characterized by one-party rule and a centralized economy for nearly 70 years, the Soviet Union expanded to include 15 republics and become the largest nation in the world, encompassing nearly one-sixth of the world's landmass. In 1947, King Michael of Romania was forced by the communists to abdicate his throne. The Romanian People's Republic was proclaimed. On this day in 1965, Ferdinand Marcos was inaugurated president of the Philippines. Marcos's regime would span 20 years and be marked by misuse of foreign aid, repression, and political murders. In 1993, Israel and the Vatican signed an agreement of mutual recognition. In 2004, on this day, a fire in a Buenos Aires, Argentina nightclub killed 194 people. In 2012, Line 6 of the Beijing subway system opened, making the metro network one of the longest such public transportation systems in the world. On this day in 1969, the folk singing trio Peter, Paul, and Mary received a gold record for their last and biggest hit single, Leaving on a Jet Plane.
All my bags are packed. I'm ready to go. I'm standing here outside your door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye, but the dawn is breaking.
Leaving on a Jet Plane was written by a very young John Denver, who was then a member of the Chad Mitchell Trio. Denver went on to an illustrious solo career in the 1970s. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
With an estimated 21 million people around the world victimized by human trafficking, the United States is fully engaged in combating what President Obama has called one of the great human rights causes of our time, modern-day slavery. Every year, the Department of State releases a comprehensive report on governmental anti-human trafficking efforts. It tracks global trends in 188 countries, including law enforcement, victim identification, and protection and prevention efforts. We have stepped up efforts to combat human trafficking abroad and in the United States, where many unwitting victims are brought. On December 11th, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security announced it had partnered with one of the nation's largest highway travel center operators to train its employees to look for signs of people being transported against their will in this country and to notify the proper authorities. Travel Centers of America will provide DHS training and awareness materials, including posters, handouts, and a public service announcement, to over 250 locations and more than 15,000 employees across the United States. These materials will help Travel Centers of America personnel and customers to identify and recognize indicators of human trafficking, as well as provide information on how to report suspected cases. Victims often find themselves in a foreign country where they can't speak the language. In addition, traffickers frequently take away the victim's travel and identity documents, telling them that if they attempt to escape, they or their families back home will be harmed, or that their families will assume the debt. Travel Centers of America's involvement in the trucking industry makes it a critical partner in the fight against human trafficking. Truck drivers who know potential indicators of human trafficking and how to report it can provide eyes and ears all around the country.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.